were to require someone to spend more than 15 consecutive days in special housing, restrictive housing, or solitary confinement, then the adult in custody can, under this bill, file a petition for review of that order. And so that's really the key for us, is to allow for individuals to actually have meaningful review, so that they're not, if they get 120 days in solitary confinement and they want to file a lawsuit, they're out of solitary confinement before the complaint's even filed. And so here the idea is that if someone's getting 120 days in solitary confinement, they can actually petition the court for review of that disciplinary action. So trying to hold DOC accountable for their disciplinary orders and actions that they're taking. I think the other thing is just to flag for everyone that, you know, one thing that we do, and depending on capacity, it varies in how effective we are, I am, at this, which is to identify bills that we believe will harm efforts to reform the criminal legal system. So there are many, over 4,000 bills were filed this past session, and they're not all criminal legal system related bills, but there are many bills that are filed and introduced that we believe do more harm than good for the criminal legal system. And so one of our responsibilities is to connect with partners, community partners, identifying those bills, educating legislators on or advocating against those bills, checking in on our website. You will start seeing when we do put out social media posts on bills that we believe the community should take notice of and potentially testify against.
I've been speaking with Zach Winston, Policy Director with Oregon Justice Resource Center. Thank you so much, Zach.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you to our engineer, and thank you.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
I'm Doug McVeigh, host of Free Culture Radio. Every month, we bring you 30 minutes of news and information about people who use drugs, as we discuss topics like safe supply, safe consumption spaces, decriminalization, legalization, harm reduction, human rights, civil rights, and much more. Tune in and listen to Free Culture Radio on the third Wednesday of each month from 6:30 to 7 p.m. Pacific here on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
Here at KBOO, we'll be kicking off our winter drive on February 20th, which happens to be National Love Your Pet Day. Isn't this a heartwarming and fun holiday? We want to ask you to please record a short 1 to 2 minute audio, or as long as a 10 minute audio, explaining your relationship with your animal family. Share experiences as well as value of relationship and any other interesting or powerful story. The animals in our life bring us incomparable companionship, whether a cat, dog, parrot, horse, or any other beloved pet. Humans have developed incredible bonds with our animal counterparts. We want to hear your experiences with your pets, and most importantly, how much you love them and how they have made your life better. Send your audio to publicaffairs@kboo.org with the subject line Pet Day. You can also call the station at 503-231-8032 and choose voice mailbox 302 and go ahead and record your story. Again, that's publicaffairs@kboo.org with the subject line Pet Day, or just call the station at 503-231-8032 and choose voice mailbox 302. Thank you.
Oh, what a world. KBOO 90.7. Dasha T said that.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroots News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on, let's talk about race. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that
race, race, race. As President Joe Biden addresses the latest international crisis, Let's Talk About Race deconstructs his domestic policy, or his failure to pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act and the For the People Act. Is this Build Back Never?
I understand the frustration with Biden, but I'm also optimistic about Biden and appreciate what he has done. I do understand the criticism. There were some things in terms of how they prioritized what they worked on when that I think made a difference, especially when it comes to voters' rights and election tampering. All of that should have been day one. And we find ourselves now with this discussion about filibuster because he has the Senate and he has the Congress. It's not enough margin. That has been the big barrier. Now, they've written excellent legislation in the Congress. It has passed the Congress and it's sitting at the Senate. That is not totally on Biden. I'm talking about the For the People Act and also the John Lewis, those two pieces of legislation. So we have excellent legislation. It's just not going anywhere.
Congressional Democrats failed to pass a federal voting rights bill in the U.S. Senate late on Wednesday, and a major setback ahead of midterm elections later this year. The bill has been a top priority for President Joe Biden, who later tweeted that he was profoundly disappointed but not deterred by the Senate's decision. The Senate is currently split 50-50 between Democrats and Republicans. In back-to-back votes late on Wednesday, Senate Republicans first blocked Democrats from advancing the voting rights legislation by using the filibuster, which requires at least 60 senators to keep bills alive. Democratic Majority Leader Chuck Schumer soon moved to lower the 60-vote filibuster threshold down to 50. That effort was quickly shot down by fellow Democrats Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, who joined Republicans in voting against the rules change.
The so-called talking filibuster proposal, smoke and mirrors. Just smoke and mirrors.
On Wednesday, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell warned against changing the filibuster rule. That's despite having done so himself to engineer Senate approval for former President Donald Trump's picks for the Supreme Court. The voting rights bill would have guaranteed that any registered voter could request a mail-in ballot, established at least 2 weeks of early voting, and expanded use of ballot drop boxes. It also targeted gerrymandering, which regularly tilts the field to whichever party is in power across various states. Democrats had argued the bill would bolster democracy after last year's deadly riot on the U.S. Capitol, when Trump supporters tried to overturn Biden's election victory. Republicans counter that Democrats have fabricated the voting rights crisis and say that little needs to be changed.
I think Biden came into office thinking that he somehow could cross the divide and didn't realize that it's not crossable, that there is not this working across the aisle. And it's taken him longer than it should have to realize that he needed to abandon that notion and be pretty forceful in moving forward. I think this question about filibuster should have happened, almost a year ago. So here we are. With the midterms coming up, this is very concerning because there's a number of laws that have already passed where I'm not sure that the midterms won't be the proverbial S show.
Or as President Obama said, a shellacking.
A shellacking, yes, yes. Okay. We could be faced with that. In which case, all of where he's at and the continuation of his agenda will go nowhere. Also, where is Kamala Harris? Do we need to put her on a milk carton and find her? I think she is MIA.
We did it, Joe.
Kamala Harris made history as the first woman, first Black American, and first Asian American to become vice president. In some ways, the fanfare around her being sworn in overshadowed Joe Biden taking the oath of office. But after less than a year in the post, she is a historically unpopular VP. Where once she was always in the frame during Joe Biden's major addresses, she has been notably absent from the president's side of late. Her diminished public presence has even prompted one US columnist to nickname her the incredible disappearing vice president. Kamala Harris has an approval rating of 28%. down from 50% when she first took office. It appears to make her the least popular vice president at this stage of an administration in at least 50 years. For context, Mike Pence's approval ratings were above 40% at the same stage of Donald Trump's administration. So why is she seen to be doing so badly? Well, there's a feeling she's not delivered on the two biggest tasks that Joe Biden has entrusted her with. First, tackling the root causes of the migrant crisis. Despite a record spike of people coming into the US, she did not go to visit Mexico and Guatemala until June, 6 months after starting the job. During an interview, she gave an incredibly tone-deaf response when asked why she had so far declined to see the conditions on the border firsthand.
This whole thing about the border, we've been to the border. We've been to the border.
You haven't been to the border.
I haven't been to Europe. And I don't understand the point that you're making.
And her public comments once she was finally in Central America surprised many. She had previously called for a more compassionate approach to those arriving at the southern border, but said this.
To folks in this region who are thinking about making that dangerous trek to the United States-Mexico border, do not come. The United States will continue to enforce our laws and secure our border.
Harris has also faced an exodus of senior staff amid reports of dysfunction within her office. The most recent high-profile departure is Simone Sanders, the vice president's spokesperson and her most prominent public defender. To help her course correct, Harris has since brought in crisis communications veterans to help her define her role and rebrand her public image. As well as her lack of experience in Washington, Harris has come under fire for her lack of visibility. She was a pillar during Biden's early televised speeches, but has often been missing from his side in recent months. The White House aides have privately suggested that Harris has brought some of the criticism upon herself, with clumsy responses during interviews. It has made it difficult, they say, for Biden to jump to her defense when he faces his own political crises. Others argue that the dip in her approval ratings are the natural consequence of the weight of expectation that engulfed her historic nomination. After all, taking on the job of being number two can automatically diminish your profile. The polling seems damning, but is all the criticism fair? The White House has blamed sexism and racism for the attacks against Harris.
I do think there has been some attacks that are beyond because of her identity.
Despite the president's spokeswoman issuing a public defense, members of Harris's inner circle have also blamed White House aides for her troubles. They argue she is being sidelined rather than positioned effectively by Biden, who knows the challenges of being number two better than anyone. They have also been keen to highlight her accomplishments, which they say are not always appreciated by a Washington press corps who compare her against her white male predecessors. They point in particular to her efforts to encourage African Americans to get vaccinated against COVID, an achievement they believe has been under-recognized. And despite all the criticism, some say her low profile could be a deliberate way to strike a delicate balance. Associating herself too closely with a struggling president could harm her own future plans. But on the other hand, any hint of further political ambition right now could damage her standing with the Biden administration.
She's worked her way up to get to where she is and give her a chance to do her job.
For now, at least, it seems she is no longer Joe Biden's heir apparent. A number of Democrats seem prepared to challenge her for the nomination should Biden not seek re-election in 2024. But with 3 years left to reverse course, it is too early to count Harris out.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, President Biden's Domestic Policy, Build Back Never.
Why do I feel like Biden lost?
I understand what you mean with that sentiment. I think arguably the most extreme material transition for folks who voted for Biden in 2020 between that election and now is that they don't have to hear about Trump anymore. The temperature has cooled off, but the virus still rages. That was my little phrase that I came up with. I like that one. All right, like our stimulus checks were smaller than they were promised. The energy and the vision that, you know, galvanized a lot of people to vote for Biden
when it comes to a more equitable economic system, voting and policing reforms to address racial discrimination. That kind of stuff hasn't materialized. So Trump being gone means that, you know, that intense worry, the watching the news around the clock to see if you're winning or you're losing has been diminished, right? Probably good for your brain, but bad for, you know, maintaining a feeling that folks who voted Democrat want their vote to matter, to have a big impact on people and the change that needs to be made. In the big scheme of things, right, not every president will fulfill on every part of their agenda. Not every president can make headway on those things in their first year. But I think we're also in a moment, thanks to COVID, thanks to economic social upheaval, that calls for big action. People see the need for big change, and to not act with urgency on those ideas, on that energy, feels like a real failure. It feels, you know, sitting around kind of waiting, the incrementalism that our political system tends towards feels utterly inappropriate. And so I think that's where you get the feeling of like, yeah, Biden jumping on the wagon of, yeah, we'll get rid of the filibuster. Yeah, we'll do this. It's like, where was your energy when that would have mattered?
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
I think that people need to remember that Biden ran in the primary and also in the general election as a moderate. He reiterated that just recently at a news conference, making it sure that people knew that he was not a, quote, socialist, end of quotation. So to be surprised at the slow pace or the direction of Biden is to not recall recent history. I think Althea made a very good point in terms of the temperature has changed because of the change in the federal administration. So we are not, you know, watching our news 24/7, waiting to hear what terrible thing has happened from the White House today. I think it is important for those who would like the president to move in a more progressive way to also recognize the limitation of the presidency in a Congress Senate where it is divided 50-50 and where two members of the president's party are preventing movement on such important legislation as voting rights, and eliminating the filibuster. Those are the people, the senator from West Virginia and the senator from Arizona, that people should direct their attention towards in terms of changing the temperature and the energy in the Congress. I think it's also important to remember that there might be a, quote, shellacking in the midterm elections, but it's also helpful to remember that in 1994, Clinton was president and the Democrats lost terribly in the midterm election. And that was the first time in 40 years that the Senate and the House came into Republican control, the Newt Gingrich revolution. But 2 years later, Clinton won re-election. So I think it's helpful to have a long-term strategy and to recognize that change often happened in small steps. So take what we think is possible, work on those issues, continue to have the dedication to fight the long struggle.
I think I've been clear over time in our conversations of just my ambivalency about the electoral process and the two-party system, and I'm not quite sure what the alternatives are to that. This conversation makes me very desperate to think, what is the alternative? What can we offer differently? I very much want to lift up what Reverend Cecil talked about in terms of who Biden is. And it reminds me of when President Obama was elected. And shortly after, there was some consternation amongst some progressives that he wasn't doing enough. And my take on that was he never wasn't who he was, which was a centrist and a moderate. Biden is a centrist and a moderate. And quite frankly, I feel like he's living in a little bit of nostalgia about, you know, whether if he shows up with his hand held out and in a gentlemanly posture, quote unquote, he will receive such back from his colleagues across the aisle. And things have been so broken for so long that that nostalgia, that anticipation that if I reach out, I will be met with trust and engagement and participation just isn't the case anymore. And while that hurts me to say it, I think we've got to make our peace with that reality. You know, I shared the comment from Dr. King, and I've been really thinking about how can the progressive movement, can people who work to make change in the world be that testament of hope amidst melancholy and discouragement? I think I disagree with previous two folks. I still feel like there's an incredible sense of urgency. The heat is incredibly on. We look at a Supreme Court that was incredibly designed to be at the place it is now, and we are only at the tip of the iceberg of the rollback of freedom and reproductive rights and everything else that we hold dear. Coming up to that court intentionally, specifically, and with malice, I will say. These conversations about election police, specialized election police, those words strike fear in my heart, dread in my heart, and it underlines the complete failure to pass the For the People Act and the complete failure to pass the Voting Rights Act. And it's been curious to me, the whipsawing that Biden and his administration have been doing. You look at what was pushed forward at the beginning of the pandemic in terms of the child tax credit and the child payments. And I don't know if people saw this, there's recently new research that was released that said the brain development of children living in low-income families was improved as a result of that additional $300 a month coming into households. Now, that was a very moderate amount. As someone said, it wasn't what was promised. It isn't what it's needed. And that one act improved the brain development of our children, and we were able to measure it in a very short period of time, all the caveats about the research notwithstanding. The administration takes that act, it takes the hit for it, it takes the heat for it, and then immediately backs out and says, well, we can't do that anymore. On every significant issue that either the Biden-Harris campaign promised or we expected that they would be engaged on, there's been this whipsawing back and forth and back and forth. And frankly, I don't know who the Biden is that's going to show up. Is it going to be the Biden that's going to, you know, swear on a hot mic and, you know, get angry and make some good speeches? Or it's going to be the Biden who's trying to hold this sort of gentlemanly, nostalgic perspective that, you know, you don't force people into it. You offer I appreciate that. I don't want us to become and have the behavior of those we abhor and those that disgust us. And it's not an effective tactic in this moment. So the question for me becomes, how do we understand the moment that we're in the brokenness that we're in and not continue to use the same old electoral politics two-party playbook at the highest level of our, you know, elected structures. What does that look like? How can that be different? I don't have an answer. That's where I think we've got to go, continuing to, you know, try to hope that something would be different, try to think that there's some strategy that could happen. That's everything we've tried in the past and more isn't working. And until we make our peace with that, our solutions are not going to be any different than the ones we have to have right now.
Nia?
Yes. So I was just looking at the most recent polls that 41% of U.S. adults approve of Biden's job performance, which is down from his numbers in September of last year, 44%, and substantially down than last April of 59%. And actually, I remember being one of those people that was so hopeful. And I knew that he had some work to do, right? There were a lot of direct reversals of policies enacted by Donald Trump that Biden needed to overturn or stop or withdraw. He had to stop the withdrawal from the World Health Organization in the middle of the largest pandemic in the history of mankind, and had to stop construction on the border wall, preserve DACA. So I had a lot of hope. I saw a lot of things happening. But lately, I feel like, you know, the average American that's being surveyed, it feels like the Biden administration is an old, outdated machine, you know, maybe like the IBM to the Microsoft, right? And it doesn't feel like they're nimble enough, they're not moving quickly enough, or, you know, what I'd like to see is a little bit more proactivity to address not just COVID, but some of the other issues like the inflation, which is not just supply chain issues, but also a consequence of our labor crisis. So I don't see, you know, these great legislative minds coming together to not just try to find solutions, but also be a little bit proactive and not always be on the defense and be on the defense against this Trump machine, where the Republicans are all dedicated and all aligned with the Trump agenda, and the Democrats are in disarray. And depending on who you talk to, it kind of feels like my company. If you ask seven different people what the value prop is my company, you'll get seven different answers of what our goal and our agenda is. You know, when you look at the average voter, especially here in Pennsylvania, this is Trump country. You know, they want to see the groceries and the brands that they like on the shelves. I mean, that's what they're talking about. They're not talking about voter suppression. They're talking about how you go to Giant Eagle and you can't get the Coca-Cola and the chips that you want, that gas prices are going up, and that they're inconvenienced by not having enough staff to support our consumer and service lifestyle. And I also agree with Professor Johnson. Where is Kamala? I mean, a lot of the news I see about her is just her dysfunctional office, this mass exodus of staff resignation. And if she wants to launch her own presidential campaign, because I don't see Biden running again for a second term, she's got to do something.
In all fairness, Biden was able to get an infrastructure bill passed, but the main beneficiaries are the ones who didn't vote for him. In a post-Trump political era where racism, sexism, and anti-history is normalized, is President Biden unable to adjust?
I don't think that Biden is in over his head. I do think what has been previously stated is true, that he has some ideas that don't work today. If that's being over his head, then I guess I would agree with that. I actually think that he's a pretty astute politician. I think he's making the same mistake that Obama made. He doesn't take credit for what he accomplishes. He doesn't get his messages out there. You know, the Freedom to Vote Act, there's great legislation that's coming out. He doesn't communicate what it is. Build Back Better. I think we can identify the broader things, but there's a lot of great things built into that legislation, and he doesn't communicate what those things are. And given that people are digesting information in a different way, I agree with Nia that he's using old tactics and he hasn't adapted that to the current environment. He isn't taking advantage of social media, the newspaper, wherever he can go. And the Democratic Congress and Senate, they should be a voice out there. They should be branding this. They should be shouting this in all of their states. And that's not happening. Now, with the lying and the stealing and racism being normalized, I think there's been a certain amount of corruption in every presidency. This is different because of the social ramifications. Our social cultural fabric in the U.S. is being pulled apart. It's starting to unravel. It's like tail wagging the dog. I don't think it's the majority of Americans. I think the majority of Americans have welcomed that they no longer have chaos and they actually have a press secretary that can communicate and they have a president that is competent. The majority of people are happy about that. And it's the fringes that have found a voice and have found some, you know, they've been sort of reaffirmed by what's happened with the Trump presidency and what Trump continues to do. They've become emboldened. They've even been complimented for just awful behaviors and what they've done in terms of igniting this racial divide.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, President Biden's Domestic Policy. Build back never.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
One thing that what Professor Johnson immediately brought to mind for me was is related to opinion polling, which Nia also brought up, that stripped away of the political language around any given policy, progressive policies poll way better with majority of Americans than Republican ones do, or more conservative ones, I should say. It really does come down to branding and what can you galvanize people around, not what makes a difference in their life. But Republicans have had that on lock for quite a while because it is much easier to ground action or inspire people to be foaming at the mouth when you're basing it in fear. There's a lot of fear to go around. Obviously, the right has chosen particularly racist, xenophobic types of fear to build themselves off of. But really, there is general consensus that, hey, something needs to be done. Republican policies are not popular on their own. They are not popular without the kind of branding and flash and sell that they're able to put on them. The average working person is okay with government spending because it means that they can put food on the table, they can have insurance, and they can ensure a better life for their kids. But that is not what Republicans have built themselves on, right? They're going after voting because the only way to win in a fair race for them is to not play. So they're going to take their ball, they're going to go home, they're going to change the rules so that they won the whole time. And it really is troubling to see that there is this kind of like fork in reality after the presidential election in 2020 of folks who appreciate that the election was fair and believe that Biden was rightfully elected and those that don't. The side that believes that he wasn't rightfully elected is very vocal, but like Professor Johnson alluded to, it doesn't necessarily represent everybody. It does pose unique challenges because folks are hearing that kind of language. That is what they're acquainted with. That is the context that they're coming to these conversations with. No matter the merits of the legislation, if you haven't heard about what's in this legislation, haven't heard what it's doing for kids, haven't heard what it's doing for older folks, like how is it possibly going to sound good to you when you just know the Democrats are the ones running child sex trafficking rings, like depending on how deep over there you are. And what this moment asks of Biden, if he wants to get his agenda done, is to actually have him go after an aspect of the establishment, which is these parliamentarian rules like the filibuster, like the way that the Electoral College is counted. And asking someone like Biden to do that is that is a wild thing to ask him to do. And he is presented with a huge mountain of problems. And I think what I was saying in our first question was that there is this urgency. We feel like we're losing because every single issue has urgency. It's too much to ask of one presidency with whatever power he has to be able to take on. But even so, I still find myself disappointed because even just in the sphere of executive action, there are actions that he hasn't taken. There hasn't been even a clear voice on COVID from the executive branch because you have the CDC downgrading quarantine rules to 5 days after Delta Airlines pushed them to, putting millions of workers at risk. So do we care about COVID? Is it a big deal or is it not? And not canceling student debt yet, right? Like there's a million different things to go after him for. Calling it a wash at this point, we should perhaps let it play out a little bit more. Branding is a huge issue, and you know, relating the policy to the impact that it would have on an individual's life is really what's missing, because the policies are agreeable. Everybody wants a better life. Everybody wants to get out of COVID. Everybody needs economic support. It's just a matter of putting a face to a name.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, President Biden's Domestic Policy, Build Back Never.
It is important to remember, except for 4 years, Joe Biden has been in elected office in Washington for 50 years. In 1972, he was the sixth youngest person ever to be elected to the U.S. Senate. He was 29. So if anyone knows how Washington works, it should be Joe Biden. He remembers a time of Washington politics where people could disagree over legislation and then go out after work for a beer together. Perhaps he romanticized that period. I don't understand why it only seems to occur to him after this past year that the Washington he knew has changed. There are different rules to play, from things as simple as branding to being able to say what you want and a very easy sound bite. Now, the president, the last week or so at a news conference, and he asked the question, what do the Republicans stand for? And that could be a good tagline. And then also say, very simple, this is what we stand for. Althea mentioned student debt. Mary spoke about the child tax credit and what it means for family. These are very simple and popular issues that working people can understand and feel. Nia mentioned how people are talking about pocketbook issues. States, very simple, this is what we will do. And run a campaign on those very simple, not simple issues, but simple to understand, pocketbook issues. There are other issues that are important. And in certain communities, voting rights are very important. And so you can emphasize those issues in different communities. But I believe enough in the human struggle for self-survival that the Democrats and President Biden will see that they have to do things differently, that things are different, and that they might discover a way in which to energize their base by being able to say, this is who we are, this is what we stand for, and this is what we have done.
We must end this uncivil war.
It's been 1 year since Joe Biden was inaugurated as President of the United States.
Hello, folks.
Mr. Biden marked the occasion yesterday with a two-hour press conference where he touted some of his successes.
We created 6 million new jobs, more jobs in 1 year than any time before. Unemployment dropped, the unemployment rate dropped to 3.9%. Child poverty dropped by nearly 40%, the biggest drop ever in American history.
But with an approval rating that has fallen 17 points since taking office, the president promised to keep working on his agenda.
Yes, I'm confident we can get pieces, big chunks of the Build Back Better law
signed into law.
The president vowed to continue fighting the coronavirus pandemic.
Some people may call what's happening now the new normal. I call it a job not yet finished. It will get better.
He blamed Republicans for obstructing progress.
I did not anticipate that there'd be such a stalwart effort to make sure that the most important thing was that President Biden didn't get anything done. Think about this. What are Republicans for?
He also told reporters he plans on getting out of the White House more ahead of the midterm elections.
I'm going to go out and talk to the public.
On the international front, President Biden said Russia would pay a dear price if President Vladimir Putin invades Ukraine.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on, let's talk about race,
baby.
Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Given everything that we have talked about, which I think is well established, right, that the Democratic platforms and agenda are much more interesting and palatable to the majority of this country. Republican ones are not so much. What do the Republicans stand for? It has me wondering, what's it going to take for us, whoever us is, to own that? There's something in the way here, right? It's not simply we don't understand how to brand. We don't understand how we market. I know that there is a lot of time and energy spent to how do we land an idea or promote it. There's something else happening here, and I'm going to go way far afield and get a little crazy here. I wonder if some of this challenge, not only with the Biden presidency, but with our progressive work in general over time and crossing these administrations, that really call into question for me whether we actually believe ourselves and our agenda to be worthy enough of taking up space, of speaking to from whatever perspective we're speaking to actually believe in ourselves. Because if we did, we'd have no problem saying, here's what we just did, and wasn't it great? And we know you care about these things, and we care about these things, and here's what we're doing on them. In very, as Reverend Prescott said, very simple language. It's this, and it's that, and we did this and that, and here's how it helped you. There's something that's getting in the way of our ability to be able to, I don't know, own it, feel legitimate with it. Is there some kind of imposter syndrome going on? And I know I'm going deep here, so you give me a little room here. There's something else happening here, because there is all of the marketing and branding and messaging assistance in the world that could be brought to bear on this. There is all of the common sense that can be brought to bear on this. There is all of the data and the research that is deep and lengthy and incontrovertible. I was just in a conversation today that looked at, over the past year and a half of the pandemic, mortgage lending and the rates of mortgage lending for African-American homeowners or people wanting to become homeowners is the worse than it's been in 129 years. Other communities have increased their ability to purchase a home, to get mortgage lending, to gain those assets related to that. There's just one example of the data that is voluminous and clear and unambiguous about the challenges for day-to-day people in their day-to-day worlds. What is missing from our analysis, from our strategy, from our ability to take action that speaks to some level of illegitimacy, imposter syndrome, or the inability to own what should be a very easy message and agenda because we stand on the side of moral righteousness. I don't understand what's going on there. And I think when I think about the two-party system, there is something intrinsically damaged about that. And that is leading to some of this, when I think about the body politics. So who's that body and what's the brain on top of that body and what's the heart in that body? And there's something that's not working about that for us on a progressive agenda. What if we all agreed that Biden was going to be a one-term president and then said, what would you do as a one-term president to push your agenda forward? It's kind of like those questions where somebody says, you got a day to live. What do? How do you spend that day? What do? What do you make sure you don't miss out on? What if Biden was a one-term president and we said to him, you got one term, what are you gonna do? What would you put the pedal to the metal on, you know, without reservation, without hesitation, and actually own that as a strategy?
Mary Lee, I love it. Absolutely. I completely agree. You know, sort of off topic, my company is starting an ERG. And one of the questions we're asking is, why do we need this? Why do we need to tell our company that we're Black and we work here? It's kind of digging a little bit deeper on, you know, why we're making these decisions. But back to the question, I like to answer it in two parts. So first part is Biden able to navigate this new landscape with the racism and the corruption? You know, Biden's been in politics long enough to see those behind closed doors racism and corruption move to the forefront. I mean, he was in those rooms navigating those spaces. Just this, the history of the politics of the last 20 years leading us to the largest lie that materialized into January 6th and our democracy in jeopardy. And I also love how, Mary Lee, you said you never know which Biden you're going to get. Are we going to get the Biden that literally said the summer of 2020, unlike the African-American community, with notable exceptions, the Latino community is an incredibly diverse community with incredibly different attitudes about different things. So is he saying that African Americans were just some big Black monolith and we look alike and we think alike? He also was quoted as saying that Obama was very clean and articulate. I always love it when I hear that. You know, over the course of his entire career, he's also praised segregationists. We know what his stance was on busing. I think that he's probably just surprised that the business as usual that was behind the scenes is, you know, out in the Senate, out on social media. People are interviewing on Fox News and they're actually saying what they've always said behind closed doors. And it's interesting because I read a funny article in The Atlantic where the author said Biden has made politics boring again. But he's also made it a little bit clueless, kind of like a grandparent that gets catfished by a grandchild scam. As far as federal voting standards, you know, Biden recently said that he believed Republicans would eventually support such federal voting standards. And he just wants to make sure that it's not just the Democrats, but we bring along the Republicans because he said they know better than this. So he's saying this even after the insurrection of January 6th and the senators who continue to support the big lie, who are also complicit in January 6th, he actually believes that these people are going to have a moral and ethical revelation and support federal voting standards. I don't know, Biden. I wouldn't put any money on that.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, President Biden's Domestic Policy, Build Back Never. At Let's Talk About Race, we know governing is difficult, especially in a democracy. It can be messy. But we want President Biden to do better, to build back better. If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on, let's talk about rape, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race. Sometimes listening to the news seems like one trauma dump after another. Therefore, at Let's Talk About Race, we've created a new segment entitled Hope is a Thing with Feathers. My example of Hope is a Thing with Feathers is this rap song, 1-800-273-8255.
And rapper Logic might have saved quite a few different people's lives. In a recent study conducted by the British Medical Journal, there was a 5.5% reduction in suicides back in 2017 when Logic released the song 1-800-273-8255. The song was, of course, named after the phone number for the National Suicide Prevention Line, and the track has now been credited with preventing actual suicides. The British Medical Journal says that when the song was at the height of its popularity, suicides amongst 10 to 19-year-olds in the U.S. declined 5.5%. They said this happened during the first 34 days after the song's release and around the time of Logic's performance of the song at the 2017 MTV Awards, and it happened again a year later in 2018 when he performed at the Grammy Awards. And the good thing about it is that this 5.5% decrease amounts to 245 less suicides over this timeline. The study also found that there was an upswing in the number of calls made to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, and they received 9,915 more calls than usual, which would equal a 6.9% increase in people reaching out for help as they were thinking about suicide. So it's clear that Logic's song did what it was intended to do, which is prevent more people from harming themselves.
I finally wanna be alive. I finally wanna be alive. I don't wanna die today. I don't wanna die. I finally wanna be alive. I finally wanna be alive.
I just want to take a moment right now and thank you all so much for giving me a platform to talk about something that mainstream media doesn't want to talk about. Mental health, anxiety, suicide, depression, and so much more that I talk about on this album. From racism, discrimination, sexism, domestic violence, sexual assault, and so much more. I don't give a damn if you're black, white, or any color in between. I don't care if you're Christian, you're Muslim, you're gay, you're straight. I am here to fight for your equality because I believe that we are all born equal, but we are not treated equally, and that is why we must fight. We must fight for the equality of every man, woman, and child, regardless of race, religion, color, creed, and sexual orientation. So I say here and now, if you believe in this message and my message of peace, love, and positivity and equality for all, then I demand that you rise to your feet and applaud, not only for yourselves, but for the foundation we are laying for our children.
So what gives me hope? I was thinking about this today, and the first thing that came to mind, because there hasn't been a whole ton of delightful news items recently, but sunshine. There's whispers of spring in the Pacific Northwest these days, and that has really buoyed my mood and allowed me to, you know, start thinking about the future again. You know, the winter gets you down in the dumps, but even with that in mind, we're seeing helpful signs of a decrease in COVID. There are plans to end mask mandates, which we can certainly debate if those are properly timed, but they are welcome additions to planning for the future, to thinking about springtime, summertime, down the line, changing all of these, changing seasons, changing our requirements of our society. I'm glad to hear those things are happening.
So let me go to Cecil. Cecil, what is your hope with a thing with feathers example?
Many people think that hope is looking at the younger generation. I want to look at the older generation. In particular, I ran across a new movement headed by Akaya Winwood and Bill McKibben, and partially inspired by the work that Neil Young and Joni Mitchell did in going after Spotify. And this movement is called the Third Act, and it is encouraging, organizing older people to take up the cause and to participate in advocacy in using their knowledge and our experience over decades of organizing, and saying that it's not quite time for us to sit back, that we have something to contribute.
Mary Lee and then Nia.
Something I've been enjoying this week is a series of articles that the Western State Center here in Portland is putting out honoring the 30th anniversary of the No on 9 campaign. This was one of the first and the most vicious series of anti-queer campaigns in our state. And this week there, the remembrance is focusing on stories of courage from people and communities of color who were a part of that campaign and worked on these issues, but also were also very little known and had to fight white supremacy both externally and inside of the campaign. And Reverend Prescott knows this very well. You were a part of that. I specifically want to lift up the story of Ramon Ramirez, who was the leader of PECUN, a farm worker, agricultural worker rights organization. And there is a moment where the queer community goes and asks for the support of PECUN and the farm workers, and they come up and stand up and greet this group of people marching down I-5 in opposition to No on 9. And there was every reason for PECUN and that group and that community to have turned their backs on the people engaged with the No on 9 committee. Every reason why that group could have, should have, many people, who organizations and communities that did. And through Ramon's leadership and his complete understanding of the shared, you know, our shared reality with each other, they stood up in a way and they made it possible for others to stand up. And while I'm remembering the past about this, the other piece of hope, or the bigger piece of hope, is thinking about the lead, today's leader of PECUN, Reyna Lopez. She is the current leader. She is a young Latina woman who was intentionally and purposefully taught and led and encouraged and made space for by these elders to be the next generation of leadership. And she and her colleagues who are now in this next generation of leadership was no accident, completely full of purpose, and they are doing an amazing job. And it made me think about our conversation about Kwanzaa, idea of Nia, and what purpose, when we center that purpose in support and service to our vision and values, what happens, what the transformation that happens. And seeing that says to me, yeah, we got a lot of work to do. There's, you know, we're gonna have a hard topic today. And I can look over 30 years of my own experience and see what purpose, intentionality, and understanding our shared future and challenges and struggles with each other, of those who maybe are not similar to I am, or I have a hard time seeing that, whatever it is, I see it, and I see it happening in my own lifetime, and that gives me tremendous hope.
Nia, hope is a thing with feathers.
Excellent. Thank you, Mary Lee, for the shout out. What gives me hope is that it's Black History Month, and I love hearing stories because there's a lot of content that we see in February that we unfortunately don't see throughout the rest of the year. So I enjoy hearing stories I've never heard of about unsung African-American men and women. And I was unfamiliar with the relationship of Nelson Rockefeller and Martin Luther King. I watched an interview with Clarence B. Jones on MSNBC last weekend and was just tickled by this story that when Martin Luther King and hundreds of children were arrested after the Children's March in Birmingham, civil rights organizers wanted to, you know, raise some cash to make bail. And a lot of people were really upset that these children had to even spend 1 minute in jail. So apparently Harry Belafonte and Clarence B. Jones got a call from the Rockefellers that said they would help, and they had $100,000 that Jones actually signed a promissory note inside a big bank vault, which I can't even imagine what that must have been like, pretty intimidating after hours in a Chase bank. And he personally signed a promissory note in exchange for $100,000 in cash. And what was interesting is he called out that this type of promissory note, he was financially on the line. And the type was, when the creditor says, "I want my money now, you better pay it in person." So the story is that the children were bailed out, and then Jones received a receipt from the Rockefellers that said paid in full. So just a reminder that hope can come from unlikely allies.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, Reading, Writing, and Book Burning. Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by Grassroot News Northwest.
Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on.
Let's talk about race, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
This is KBOO Portland.
What does the average KBOO listener think of self-help radio?
This is so hard and complicated.
I have no idea what it is.
What is this old-time music?
I feel so proud of myself.
It seems kind of worthless.
Why does it have to make so much noise?
It is very hipster.